Yeah. Airing on Asheville FM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're sharing an interview with Heatscore and Nuke of Submedia about their new documentary series, Interrebellium. The first episode, entitled El Estallido Social, is about the social uprising that flared up in 2019 in lands controlled by the state of Chile, featuring anarchist and Mapuche voices on the conditions in which the uprisings developed, experiences of it, and its aftermath. You can view the film for free at sub.media/interrebellium alongside materials for discussion. We also speak about the role of film and media production in radical organizing and critique, as well as upcoming episodes of the series.
I'm Nuke. I'm with the Submedia Collective. I use they or he pronouns, and I'm located in the northeastern United Snakes.
And I'm Heatscore, he, him. I'm up in Canada, up in so-called Hamilton, Ontario.
Awesome. Thank you both for joining for this conversation. Can you talk a little bit about Submedia, like a little bit about its history, what sort of projects you all do, the goals of it, everything? Everything. Give me everything.
Sure. Yeah. So Submedia is a longstanding anarchist filmmaking collective. So we've been around for over 20 years now. And during that time, we've put out a number of different series and videos, hundreds of videos covering a wide variety of topics through like an anarchist and anti-colonial lens. Some of the most well-known were The End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, Trouble. We've done a series called A is for Anarchy, System Fail, and our most recent one is Interrebellium.
Y'all just released the first film in a series called Interrebellium. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you talk about the theme of the series and the release schedule that you're planning for it?
Sure. We plan on, you know, this being a years-long project, obviously. We plan to interview people from all over the world and make a series of documentaries focusing on uprisings in different countries. We just did the first episode is on Chile, but we have plans to cover Canada, the United States, France, Iraq, Sudan, Hong Kong, and Haiti and Ecuador. And this is, you know, going to be about the sort of global uprisings from around 2018 through 2020. And we see these as like sort of a interconnected wave of uprisings. We hope for our social impact to, you know, to bring together people in different locales to watch these videos and to really, you know, think critically about their local revolutionary movements and to have discussions, like take the lessons that the people that we interview learned and like apply them to their movements at home so that we can relate our histories on a global scale.
Yeah, I'll just add, I mean, I think in the past, we've kind of handcuffed ourselves a little bit with tight deadlines or to have like a regular series. With this one, we're being a little bit more intentional and the videos are going to be significantly longer than anything we've done before. We're kind of expecting, I mean, we would like to put out two of them a year if we can. I think that would probably be ambitious. It'll probably be a little bit less than that. But we do have plans to devote the next, you know, 5 years or so on this project if we want to cover everything. And hopefully during that time, there'll be new uprisings that we may decide to include.
Yeah, maybe some long-lasting, you know. All right, so how did post-revolutionary utopic Sudan come into being? Let's talk about the trajectory and all the pain and the struggle that people went through. And, like, inshallah, you can have some positive outcomes to measure by the end of that. That's really fascinating. And, yeah, having watched the first one, I think I mentioned planning on mentioning later, but that an hour and a half, like the Trouble episodes, I think were about a half an hour each, which are nice little bite-sized things to, you know, put out on a more regular basis. But it seems only fair to yourselves with the scope of this first episode of Inter Rebellium to give yourselves a chance to, you know, take the time that's necessary to make a really sharp product. Why does now seem, or I guess whenever you started planning this, why does now seem like a good time to speak about rebellions, their ignition, and their declines? Like, so-called Chile seems like a really rich place to focus on discussion, with histories of bleak repression and long intergenerational cultures of resistance. But was there a part of the imagination of Inter Rebellium? Like, was there a specific timeliness to the inspiration of it, or just because we're always kind of between rebellions? Maybe not always.
I think we needed to do this at a time where the lessons learned are still within the living memory, so that, you know, the importance of these rebellions doesn't get lost to history, because, you know, nobody's going to document them for us, right? Like, we have to, from within our movements, you know, put together these lessons and think about them. Yeah, I think we had just spent some years working on a piece called System Fail, which would come out every couple of weeks. And when we were doing that, we were just like married to this news cycle. And I think we wanted to get away from that, right? We wanted to like take some time and really do something that was going to be like a deep, impactful, and analytic type of document, like series. And like, to be able to have the time to do that, we have to free ourselves from being married to this news cycle, this like constant source of like outrage and distraction and like, you know, ever changing like think pieces. We needed to just, you know, do something longer format and deeper and more introspective for our movements, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I will just kind of add to this. I think that, I mean, there's a general feeling that there is, you know, we're in a period of kind of a, like a lull or a sort of a down period. I think that there's a lot of demoralization and you know, disillusionment and despair around the world these days. But I also kind of get the sense that there is another big wave coming, that there's a lot of early warning signs of this. And, you know, for us, I mean, the idea of this series and the name Inter Rebellium being sort of Latin for between uprisings is kind of looking at, first of all, the connections between these different uprisings that took place in different parts of the world, but then also, yes, the period of time in between these kind of big surges of revolutionary fervor. And I do think that that is a time when we need to be studying the limits that previous uprisings sort of encountered, and so that our movements can be prepared to make interventions and to avoid these pitfalls and to push future rebellions even further. So we think that anarchists in particular have a catalyzing and important role to play in uprisings. We're not able to carry off revolutions by ourselves, but we can provide like an important spark and in helping to push them further. And so this series is intentionally aimed at sort of trying to cultivate that level of preparation, I think, for the next wave, which we do see coming soon.
So episode one, entitled The Estallido Social, is about the uprisings in so-called Chile beginning in October of 2019. Could you tell listeners a bit about the films, from the background, like what you covered and whose voices and experiences you featured?
Yeah, so The Estallido Social was a roughly 6-month long popular insurgency in the territories controlled by the Chilean state. We did this film in collaboration with a number of anarchist individuals and collectives based in Chile and in the Chilean diaspora. So I think we interviewed 7 people, including mostly anarchists. There's one person we interviewed who does not identify as an anarchist, who's a Mapuche activist. But yeah, and then we worked with a videographer from Santiago who helped to conduct the interviews and yeah, and then we kind of were in collaboration with a bunch of these people throughout the editing process and kind of, you know, working with them and running things by them and trying to navigate the dense world of Chilean slang. But yeah, that, so essentially they tell the story of particularly an anarchist lens of the Estallido Social and the ultimate repression and recuperation of the movement before it was ultimately kind of quashed, as many of these other uprisings were, by the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdowns and everything that came along with it.
And so to like encapsulate the, you know, histories of repression, memories of repression in the country, there's a spike in the cost of public transit fares that leads to student and other like working class protests that sort of that generalizes in response to like broad dissemination of images and video of police reaction and repression and just like blows up into this amazing and absolutely huge social popular uprising that, like, I think y'all did a really interesting job of bringing in these different elements of what influenced the shape and development of that uprising that, you know, the Estallido Social. Yeah, I think that was, it was really fascinating. It's very good storytelling. And that's really great that you were able to, and it makes sense that you were able to like check in with folks on the ground and folks who were there and experienced it about the way that you told the story. It comes out in the final product, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I just, the Chile has, you know, long been an inspiration for members of Submedia, and I think for a lot of anarchists, it's arguably, I think, the strongest anarchist movement in the Western Hemisphere. And the Estallido Social was really bringing together a kind of a tapestry of different popular movements. And so we kind of focus on the student movement, which had a lot of overlap with like the anarchist movement in Chile, the feminist movement, and then the Mapuche struggle against the Chilean state. And I mean, there are other sort of, you know, like that doesn't cover the entire scope of the social movements in Chile, but those are kind of like the main ones that we saw as like constitutive forces of this broader social uprising.
Yeah. And we see just how far the state is willing to go to, like, it will literally mutate itself and transform itself to hold on to power. Like they were, you know, they ousted their, they held elections for a new president. They were ready to totally rewrite their constitution, like whatever, like ways that they could, you know, recuperate and, you know, maintain their own, you know, power and hegemony, like over the people. Like it's really interesting because, you know, Chile is, you know, one of the first places where like the system of neoliberalism really took a hold, and the U.S. had a lot to do with that, of course, but, you know, it really was like a laboratory in repression. And, you know, that's like, I guess it was Isa that said that, like, you know, long histories of repression often are coupled with these long histories of resistance. So definitely a lot to cover in this. like we could have gone over 90 minutes.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you didn't try to do it in a 30-minute trouble episode. And you couldn't have, but yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so, I mean, speaking on this same topic, I guess I really appreciate the discussions of the aftermath and the hindsight by the guests. Counterinsurgency, recuperation by the social democrats to save the capitalist state, discussion of the emotional impacts of those who were on the ground and who had loss, prison sentences, police retribution, the eye injuries from less lethal munitions aimed at activists' heads. This film tells a story of how the past doesn't pass and that the survivors carry the scars, memories, and relationships to the next stage in struggle. Would you talk a bit about memory and sort of what the film shows about rejecting the state and the media's periodization of rebellion?
Yeah, well, we're seeing now, like, the state and media's response to this, it basically amounts to gaslighting at a societal scale, right? Like, they don't want this to happen again. They don't want us to remember that we have the power to threaten the foundations of the state. And like, they're going to do whatever disinformation, misinformation, like narrative changing that they can to, you know, put bookends on this revolt. Like we saw a little bit in Chile, but we saw in the US, like, conflating anarchists with the far right is a big one, right? Like when Trump supporters tried to, you know, do the January 6th insurrection, they were like, oh, well, those are anarchists, when nothing, you know, that's completely further from the truth. Like, those people just want to, you know, morph the state into their own thing. They don't want to, like, destroy it. Yeah, it's up to us to keep the memories alive, because the state's going to try to change things and tell it in a way that directs people towards working within bureaucracy and working within the system. And we know that's not the path for liberation to anyone.
Yeah. I mean, I think like our goal with this really is to be chronicling some of the movement history, because there is so much of it that is lost by the twin forces of repression and recuperation, by either killing or maiming or imprisoning those who actually are the living embodiment of these struggles, who carry those lessons with them, right? So for us, I mean, that is a big driving force behind this project, is just to chronicle these stories to be able to kind of be a thread that connects these different uprisings to one another, or and also across time and space. So yeah, I mean, it's something that's very much encoded and intentional within the project, and it's something that that we do see as a necessary contribution that we're trying to make.
So yeah, weighing in at a hefty hour and a half in length, the documentary is cinematically striking, has an engaging soundtrack, and tons of amazing footage. It also, as you warned at the beginning, has a lot of really depressing and shocking images and descriptions of police and military violence. But can you talk about producing this film, the connections that you made to folks on the ground or cinematographers, if travel was required, and the sort of like the nitty gritty of it? Also, how long did it take to complete this?
So we spent about probably 8 months on this project, I would say, roughly. Originally, we had planned it to be a shorter film, and we were hoping to release it on the 5th anniversary of the Estallido Social, which was October 18th of last year. And once we actually got our hands on all of the interview footage, we realized quickly that was not going to be possible. One thing that was very interesting about the production process is, I mean, all of our conversations with the comrades there were in Spanish, and none of the Submedia members or the current Submedia members are native Spanish speakers. So that was something we had to navigate. I mean, some of us do speak, conversational Spanish in various states of brokenness. But it was an interesting logistical hurdle, and one that we kind of, again, anticipate with a project like this. And it is something that is cool to try to kind of overcome. And then, in terms of the production process, so I mean, we used found footage, which is kind of our sort of trademark sort of way of editing, is we just sort of jack as much footage as we can from the internet and various other places. So, you know, one of the films that we took a lot of footage from was My Imaginary Country, or Mi País Imaginario, which is by Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman, who's pretty well known for doing like a series, trilogy series called The Battle of Chile, but produced this film, which was, I think, nominated for an Oscar. And it was so full of like beautiful footage, but it was just so garbage and such a liberal take on this uprising. Whereas, like, you know, they succeeded in getting Boric elected, and like, this is the dream of Salvador Allende, like, come back to, you know, to reality or whatever. And the guy was not even there for the uprising. He lives in France. He kind of flew back. So we were like, well, we're going to steal all of your footage and make a better movie with it. And then we also, you know, we worked with, you know, some like Chilean filmmakers, as I mentioned, one of the comrades who did a lot of the filming for us. So Valentina, she actually did travel around Chile, and so we were able to fundraise to cover all of her travel costs, and we were able to purchase some equipment and stuff like that. And that's like another thing that we do want to do with this project is kind of try to, you know, funnel some resources to anarchist media collectives in other parts of the world, and, you know, and help them to kind of to use some of our kind of first world largesse or whatever, even though we're a bunch of broke dirtball filmmakers, to get them some proper gear to work with and stuff like that. So yeah, so that was kind of the nitty grits. It was difficult to do it in Spanish. We stole a lot of the footage, and then we had a lot of the heavy lifting was done by comrades on the ground.
So years ago, y'all produced a monthly series called Trouble that we've mentioned a couple times that covered a range of topics of interest to anarchists, promoted group screenings, and was paired with study materials. I know that our local Black Cross chapter did regular showings that were followed by like fruitful discussions at the local info shop. Near the end of the first installment of Interrebellum, Estallido Social, Isa from Valparaiso speaks about the spectacular function of Netflix as an example on the imagination of revolt and possibility. Can you talk a bit about the social consumption of media and your hope in creating a series like Interrebellum and what tools you package with it?
Sure. Yeah, we are absolutely inundated with just this disposable media these days, just like an endless screen of like mindless TikTok videos and dances. And it's like anyone with a camera phone can, you know, go viral over the most mundane or like, you know, stuff. So we were really intentional when we created this, that, you know, we want people to watch it in their communities. We want people to put on screenings of it. It comes with like a little zine that is, you know, has some discussion questions in it, like an introduction to the film. Yeah. And this is like one of the first times, you know, like other stuff we've put out, I've been sort of like the next day or two, I'll, you know, have a tab open for every social media account that we have and like, you know, tally the views, how many comments, what are people saying about it. And today I haven't even, you know, I haven't gone on because I know the value isn't, you know, clicks and likes for this. The value is, you know, the passing the lessons on. And we do that through like, you know, getting together and consuming media in community and talking about it. And this is, you know, meant to be a long lasting project. Like, this is going to be relevant for a long time. You know, we wanted to document history here, and that's, yeah, something that we hope that doesn't just like sit on our server somewhere. We hope people will screen these for years to come.
I'll just add, in terms of the Trouble screenings, verse that we, when, cause I was working on Trouble, with Frank Lopez at the time, and the Asheville screenings were always the one that we were basically the deadline that we set. We always knew that you guys were going to be screening it right at like 7 o'clock or whatever it was. So whenever we were working on that, I don't know if we ever passed this along to you, but we would just be like, we need to finish this for Burst.
I'm so sorry. People probably Burst, got digestive.
They're in a room waiting for us to publish this. So
they're just staring at the screen waiting for their content.
But yeah, just to echo, I think what,
sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, just to echo what Nuke said, I mean, we really, during Trouble, we heard a lot from a lot of people about how formative it was for local scenes to have a space where people could kind of have these conversations, and that there were actual organizing projects and collectives that came out of it, which is really gratifying, a lot more gratifying than getting, yeah, a bunch of likes on Instagram or whatever. And we don't know where this is going to go. I mean, we're still kind of getting our footing with this new series, but this is some one side of things that we really do want to build on and be intentional about as well, is how we're developing this kind of network and what sort of potential there is for that beyond just like the one-off sort of local screenings. And so we've heard back from people that we know of that there's been like about 30 of these screenings organized so far in cities and in countries around the world, from you know, a bunch of places in the US to Sao Paulo and Porto Alegre in Brazil, a couple of other cities, in Berlin, Copenhagen, and I think also in Bali and Indonesia and stuff. So we are hoping that people engage with this. Oh, St. Petersburg, also want to shout out the Russian comrades. We were kind of working with them to try to get the subs up in time for them to do their screening on Monday. So we're hoping that this kind of network continues to grow, and that this is a useful tool for people in their local communities to help build up their local scenes and to help sharpen their analysis together.
Yeah, that's really impressive. That's great. What languages do you have the subtitles translated into? And was it a political choice to not translate Paco? That's me kind of teasing. Sorry. I noticed when I'll cut that. But when I was watching it last night, I noticed that Paco came up in the subtitles as Paco. And I didn't know that was like...
Right. Sorry. Yeah, I think we used the term pig once or twice. There was a couple people doing it. It is one of those things that there's not a obvious translation for. But yes, sometimes we would call them Paco. Sometimes it was cop. Sometimes it was pigs. In terms of like the languages, so we have a pretty good system of translators that help us translate things into French, Spanish, and Portuguese. And then we've already had this one translated into Russian, as I mentioned. So we're hoping in the future to have these available in other languages as well, including hopefully Arabic, Italian, German, Greek. So now we can guarantee that each of them are going to be in English, French, Spanish, and Portuguese.
And I just really hope that specifically our US-based viewers can, you know, get over the fact that it's going to be 90 minutes of subtitles on a screen. Like, I know, like, whatever, we're in the land of Hollywood and stuff is made for the US, but if we're, you know, really going to commit to having an revolutionary internationalist movement, like, you know, reading translations is just going to be part of, you know, what's going to be part of what's needed to communicate these ideas over long distances and different cultures. I think it was definitely humbling for me to use my broken Spanish to communicate with comrades in Chile. And I get that the US is really big and like you can travel in any direction and everybody still speaks English a long ways, but like the world is shrinking and
in so many ways in technology. I mean, and then that just kind of proves that how expansive it is. And as far as like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to include this in here, but Chilean friends of mine that when I like meet up with them and I speak Spanish a bit, cause they don't feel comfortable speaking English, they always comment on how my Spanish sounds like a child speaking like a 6 year old, maybe 4 year old probably. So it's Chilean Spanish, like the rapidity at which people were speaking in the documentary was pretty impressive, but I think you did a good job on timing out the subtitles so they didn't disappear too fast.
Yeah, my Spanish is not great, and then I'm also Canadian, so I just like end up apologizing for how bad my Spanish is like constantly. Which adds like another dimension to it.
Growing up in California, I was like mostly speaking with folks from Central America and folks from Mexico, like outside of Mexico City. And so like the speed at which people speak tends to be, I don't know if that's like an affiliate, like because a lot of the people were from rural places and people in rural places tend to speak more slowly or whatever. But when I listen to people from like a big city in the Spanish speaking world speak, it's just so fast and so full of jargon that like you have to be a local to understand. But
yeah, I mean and that was what happened when we shared it with I shared a couple clips with Frank Lopez, who's Puerto Rican, and he was laughing about the Chilean, like the one anonymous anarchist that we interviewed was from Santiago, is the amount of slang that he used was just hilarious. Like it was and actually trying to get that translator, we used a translator from Mexico for help with some of that stuff. And he had a rough time.
I bet. This year saw the death of comrade to many of us, Murphy Hoops, just as his documentary Fell in Love with Fire was released. Do you want to say anything about this documentary and Murphy's relationship to In Rebellion episode 1?
I didn't know Murphy well. But we did, I was put in touch. We had some mutual friends, and I ended up reaching out to them early on when we were first starting out with organizing the interviews for this. And he was so helpful. And we ended up talking for a couple hours, and he just really opened up his Rolodex. And he had spent a couple of different stints in Chile and was there during the Estadio Social, and was really like vibrant and larger than life figure who very clearly was very social and made friends everywhere that he went. And so he had a lot of comrades in Chile. And yeah, he put us in touch with some excellent people. And then from there, like that was kind of the initial spark for us sort of getting the collective together and starting to sort of figure out what this was going to look like, who we were going to interview, who could help with like videography and stuff like that. So his role in this was huge for somebody who was not directly a member of the Submedia Collective. And at the time, I mean, he was like, yeah, I'm working on a documentary as well. And he was planning on releasing it on the same day as us. And so there was a period of time when we thought that they were both going to come out on the same day. And we were like, well, you know, that's cool. Maybe people can screen both of them as like a back-to-back. And we thought at the time that this was going to be a shorter film. So, but yeah, he was very generous. And we checked in several times after that. And he was very interested and invested in the project and wanted to know updates. And when we were struggling with like finding somebody to talk on a certain topic, like he again would kind of like reach out to mutual contacts and stuff like that. And so, yeah, he was incredibly helpful, very, very generous and special comrade. And so it was a big surprise to hear about his death and, very sad. And, you know, we know that he touched a lot of people. So we ended up dedicating the film to him kind of at the end, which is, you know, the least that we could do. But yeah, hopefully when people are watching it, they should, I guess, like that's something we thought about even just giving a heads up to people because we know that it's still pretty raw for folks. So just so people know, there is going to be a picture of them at the end. And yeah, just that we wanted to thank him for all of the help that he gave us.
So Submedia also put out two of three episodes of the series of short documentaries in collaboration with anarchist and author Peter Gelderlos called Revolution or Death. Could you tell us a little bit about the series, what sparked it, and what feedback you've gotten?
Sure. So it's Revolution or Death. It's a three-part series that we're making in collaboration with Peter Gelderlos. He's the author of How Nonviolence Protects the State, among others, but that's, I guess that was like the big one for me and how I first heard of him. And I had been a fan of his writings for a while. So he reached out to us with this idea for, a series that he narrates that was, looking at climate change and resistance to it and sort of the, recuperation by green energy corporations and how there are things that will work and things that won't work. And the things that aren't going to work are allowing big energy corporations to continue to greenwash and start like a whole other poisonous, energy extractive capitalism that's not fossil fuels now, it's based on lithium, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've collaborated with Peter a few times with Submedia, and he's always been one of our favorite people to interview, always very insightful. So we were happy to collaborate with him on this. And yeah, it's been great. Peter has written the script and has like a sort of a artistic vision for these. The second one was more interview based, so that was kind of more similar format to kind of like Trouble or Interrebellum, although a little bit shorter. And then Peter just wrote the intro and outro for it. And so the first one covered kind of the greenwashing hoax of the alternative energy fuel industry. And then the second one looked at some past examples of inspiring struggles waged by different people on different front lines, including Slato from the Gidimden clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, Neto from Teros Pogos, and Issa from the ZAD in Notre Dame de Lande. And then the third one is basically going to be sort of more, I think, like a bit of a how-to guide about how people can get started where they are. And I think that overall, the plan is to package the three of them together with a screening kit, sort of like we've been doing with Into Rebellion, so that people can actually start to talk about what are some of the local sources of, you know, ecological destruction in the area. You know, what are some other sort of priorities that people would need in order to build up our resilience of our communities in the face of ongoing ecological collapse, which is sort of at this point kind of baked in, right? I think that one of the things that Peter in particular wanted to do with this series, I don't want to speak for him, but in our conversations, he talked about kind of wanting to really sort of try to jolt people out of this kind of attachment that they have to sort of